The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. We have no sponsors for this month's program. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's start off with the Reader's Digest drama in real life. When a psycho computer on a jumbo airliner goes rogue and grabs the control from the pilot, 315 people find themselves facing disaster. Flight 72 is in trouble, and there's a picture of two gentlemen in a cockpit looking out the front window of their airliner, but no indication at that point that there's a panic. Returning from the bathroom, Second Officer Ross Hale steps into the right-hand seat next to Captain Kevin Sullivan in a Qantas jet combat. "No change," the American-born Sullivan says. He is referring to the Airbus A330's 303 autopilot at altitude as it cruises at 37,000 feet above the Indian Ocean on a blue sky day. Within a minute, the plane's autopilot mysteriously disconnects. That forces Sullivan to take manual control of Qantas Flight 72, carrying 303 passengers and 12 crew from Singapore to Perth, Australia. 5 seconds later, stall and overspeed warnings begin blaring. "Stall! Stall!" they screech. The overspeed warnings sound like a fire alarm. Ding, 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 ding. Caution messages light up the instrument panel. "That's not right," Sullivan exclaims. "How can the plane stall and overspeed at the same time?" In case you're not aware, stall means an aircraft is going too slow to maintain flight. The aircraft is telling him it's flying at both maximum and minimum speeds, and 30 seconds before, nothing was wrong at all. "You better get Peter back," Sullivan says. Minutes earlier, First Officer Peter Lipsett left for his break. Hales picks up the plane's intercom to try to track him down. In the rear galley, flight attendant Fuzzy Medeva relaxes after collecting meal trays from passengers. Window blinds are drawn in the cabin, and calm has descended following lunch service. Some passengers stand in line for the bathrooms. An off-duty Qantas captain and his wife, who have been on vacation, join Mylava. "Hey, Fuzz, where's your wine?" they ask. "Just help yourself," Mylava says, laughing. Boom! A crashing sound tears through the cabin. In a split second, Mylava, the off-duty captain, and his wife are propelled into the ceiling and knocked out. In the cockpit, Sullivan instinctively grabs the control stick and the movement he feels of the plane's nose pitch down violently. It is 12:42 p.m. He pulls back on the stick to thwart the jet's rapid descent, bracing himself against an instrument panel. Nothing happens, so he lets go. If the plane suddenly returns control to him, pulling back might worsen the situation by pitching the nose up and causing a dangerous stall. Within 2 seconds, the plane dives 650 feet. In a gut-wrenching moment, all that the pilots can see through the cockpit window is the blue of the Indian Ocean. "Is my life going to end here today?" Sullivan asks himself. His heart is thumping. Qantas Flight 72 is in dire trouble. The captain has no control over his airplane. Seconds after the A330 nose dives, the plane slowly begins to respond to Sullivan's control stick movements. As it does, he lets the plane continue to descend before gingerly leveling off and climbing back toward 37,000 feet. It is too late for the more than 60 passengers and crew who were not belted into their seats and were bounced around as they were trapped in a pinball machine. Mylava lies in the rear galley floor after hitting the ceiling. On the way down, he hit the galley bench and was thrown against the meal cart storage. Regaining his senses, Mylava sees blood gushing from the off-duty Qantas captain's head. He lies unconscious on the floor. The captain's wife, a senior Qantas flight attendant, begins to recover consciousness. Beyond the galley curtain, two unaccompanied young sisters, Mylava has been watching over scream. With fear in her eyes, the younger one reaches a hand out to Mylava. Barely conscious, he can't do anything to comfort her. Oxygen masks dangle from the ceiling, swaying from side to side. Baggage and broken bottles litter the cabin floor. Suddenly, a passenger from an Indian tour group rushes into the galley in panic, pointing at an inflated life jacket around his neck. His face is turning blue. "The guy's choking," Mylava shouts. The off-duty captain's wife hands a pen to the passenger, pointing at the nozzle in the life jacket. Thrusting the pen into the nozzle, the passenger deflates his jacket and gasps for breath. Seconds later, he bows in gratitude. Mylava tells him bluntly to get back to his seat. Four stages of fear and confusion. And it's, there's a picture here of the aircraft doing what it's supposed to be doing, flying. And it's stage one. The automated system wrongly measures the plane's pitch to be at 50-degree angle to the ground. The actual pitch is 2%. Stage two, as the computer forces a plane to correct its position, it jerks the craft downward to it, minus 8.4 pitch. Anyone on board who isn't buckled into the seat is propelled into the cabin ceiling and then into a free fall. By the way, that's why you should always wear your seat belt in an airplane. You don't have to have it tight, but you should always wear it. Stage three, seconds after the aircraft dives 650 feet, the captain regains control and brings it back up to cruising altitude. Stage 4. Less than 3 minutes later, without warning, the plane drops 400 feet. Takes 15 seconds for the computer system to react to the captain's command. In the cockpit, overspeed and stall warnings keep ringing to the pilot's ears even as the plane recovers to 37,000 feet above the Indian Ocean. Sullivan and Hales have no idea what caused the plane to dive. The computer system does not tell them. Sullivan hand flies as they begin responding to fault and warning messages. One of the aircraft's three primary flight control computers, which pilot referred to as PRIMS, is faulty. They begin to reset it by flicking the off-on switch. Then, without warning, the plane dives again. Sullivan pulls back on the control stick, and as he did in the first pitch down, lets go. It takes several seconds for the plane to respond to the commands. In a little more than 15 seconds, the Qantas jet falls another 400 feet. In the rear galley, Mayava senses the aircraft is about to plunge again. The moment he hears a roar, in absolute fear, he locks eyes with the wife of the off-duty Qantas captain. The second nosedive, less than 3 minutes after the first, propels them towards the ceiling again. They avoid hitting it by hanging onto a handrail. Lying on the floor seconds later, Mayava prays death will come quickly and without pain. "What the hell was that?" Hales explains to Sullivan. "It's the Prim," the captain replies. A realization of their predicament has dawned on Sullivan. The flight control computers, the brains of the plane, are supposed to keep the plane within an operating envelope, maximum altitude, maximum minimum G-force speed, and so on. Yet against the pilot's will, the computers are making commands that are imperiling all on board. In the rear galley, the wife of the off-duty Qantas captain helps her husband and Mayava as best she can. Mayava is eager to get seated. "We have to move. We have to get to our seats," he says. Together, they shuffle to a nearby jump seat. Minutes later, they hear an announcement over the PA from the captain. Sullivan tells the passengers to expect to land within 15 minutes at a remote airport in Western Australia, town of Lernmouth, where emergency service will be waiting. And there's a picture here of Fuzzy Mayava. He's endured 8 operations since the incident. He's a dark-skinned man with a mustache and a shaved head, good-looking young man. With Qantas Flight 72 diverting, Western Australia police at a small medical center kick into gear. Because of the airfield's remoteness, the emergency services need at least 30 minutes to prepare. The services in the area are basic. The fire truck and 2 ambulance. Yet Sullivan still does not know whether they can land. The computer system is not telling them what data it is sampling and what it is doing. Thoughts race through the captain's mind. What is my strategy? How will I stop a pitch down if it happens during landing? Circling Lermoth, the pilots run through a checklist. The plane's 2 engines are functioning, but the pilot does not know whether the landing gear can be lowered or the wing flaps extended for landing. Even if they can extend the flaps, they still have no idea how the plane will react. As much as they can, the pilots try to assert control over the A330. They punch Lermoth Airport into the computer used for navigation. The computer shows an error. It means they will have to conduct a visual approach. The precariousness of the situation is laid bare in lengthy summary of error messages on their screens. They include the loss of automatic braking and spoilers to prevent lift once the plane is on the runway. Sullivan plans to rely on a strategy he practiced in fighter jets. Born in San Diego, he became a Navy pilot when he was 24. Within 2 years, he was flying F-14 jets from the USS America during the Iran hostage crisis. In 1982, he was selected for Top Gun, the Navy's fighter weapons school made famous by the film of the same name. In 1983, he became one of the first U.S. Navy exchange pilots with the Royal Australian Air Force. His stay in Australia was meant to last 3 years, but after marrying an Australian and having a daughter, he joined Qantas. Sullivan has to use all of his experience to bring Qantas Flight 72 down safely. Flying at 10,000 feet above the Lermoth Airport, He intends to reduce power and descend into a spiral before lining up on the runway, flying in fast in the hope of preventing another dive. Minutes later, Sullivan lowers the A330's nose and reduces the power to idle as it begins a final approach. First Officer Peter Lipset reminds him that the speed is greater than it should be. "Noted," Sullivan replies tersely. 70 minutes after the first dive, the wheels of the A330 scrape the runway at Learnmouth. Passengers clap wildly as it glides along the tarmac. As the plane grinds to a halt, Sullivan turns to his pilots. "So a little excitement in an otherwise dull day," he quips, imitating Arnold Schwarzenegger in True Lies. The plane's cabin looks like a scene from a disaster movie, and there's a picture of it. It's the upstairs storage things are popped out, the oxygen masks are down. I mean, it really is a mess. Passenger compartment doors have been ripped from hinges. Smashed bottles, glasses, and baggage are strewed on the floor. "It looks just like the Incredible Hulk had gone through in a rage and ripped the place apart," Sullivan recalled later. Qantas Flight 72's brush with disaster happened almost 10 years ago on October 7, 2008. The day still haunts Sullivan and Maeva. Sullivan took 8 months off work. When he returned, he was hyper-alert and concerned about another potential loss of control. He continued to fly, but he no longer enjoyed the job that had once defined him. He retired 3 years ago after 3 decades at Qantas. Like Sullivan, Maeva still suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder. He has not had paid work since the incident and suffers chronic physical and psychological injuries. "I get spasms continuously, every day, nonstop. Those are what trigger the flashbacks, the memories, the nightmares. It just hasn't gone away," he says. Until they printed out the maintenance log after landing, the pilots did not know that the A330 had sustained 10 simultaneous failures at the same moment. Instead of alerting them to the failures, the computer system responded on its own to the faults, and Sullivan could not override it. "There was one air data computer that went rogue," he says. "It didn't identify itself to say, 'I'm going psycho.' As a human, I should have right to veto the computer's commands." The events of October 7, 2008 are not merely about how 3 airline pilots found themselves fighting to save a passenger plane from itself. It serves as a cautionary tale as society accelerates towards driverless cars, trucks, and trains. In the air, complex computer systems already oversee a new generation of planes, reducing the control of the pilots who spend long periods of flights keeping watch. The technology has helped make the world's ever more crowded skies safer. Yet paradoxically, it is technology that threatened the lives of those on Qantas Flight 72. Even though these planes are super safe and so easy to fly, when they fail, they are presenting pilots with situations that are confusing and potentially outside their realm to recover, Sullivan says. "To me, it's a cautious sign on the highway of automation that says, hey, can you completely remove the human input?" Laugh lines. Let's play password. Kenny Loggins should team up with Kenny Passwords. Glad my car insurance company requires a 10-character password to log in. Wouldn't want someone to back in and pay my insurance bill. I hate it when I forgot my password and can't answer my secret question right. It's like I don't even know me. I've had that happen. I hope you haven't. I've just reset my password to Delicate Luggage Handler. I was told it had to be a case sensitive. Oh, awful. I needed a password 8 characters long, so I picked Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs. My mother's maiden name is Password. Learning to trust again. National interest. Many people have become blind to the goodness in their fellow Americans. One sociologist wants to change that. Learning to trust again. And they have a listing of the people that, how trustworthy people think other people are. Here's the professions. Mail carrier is 45%. Dog walker is 33%. Bartender is 26%. Co-worker is 60%. Teacher is 64%. A handyman is 30%. Clergy are 69%. Your hairdresser is 49%. Family doctor is 73%. Garbage collector, 22%. Lawyer, 37%. I'm surprised it's not 15%. Next door neighbor, 55%. We asked 5,500 Americans if you lost $100 and it was found by someone from your life on this list. Do you trust that he or she would return it to you? And these are the percentage. In-laws, 71%. Mechanic, 32%. Babysitter, 41%. Police, 64%. Grocery cashier, 36%. Dry cleaner, 27%. My wife and I were at a crowded grocery store not long ago. It was a weekday evening, cold and wet and tense. People were carelessly blocking aisles, grumbling and snarling, and cutting off one another with their carts. At one point, two women traded insults for several minutes after colliding in the freezer section. Things got worse at the checkout line. The cashier scanned a man's discount card, but he misread the savings on her screen as an additional charge. He was decided she was acting maliciously and began to argue. "She's being spiteful," he yelled. "This is un-bleeping-believable." Other customers looked away as the cashier tried to reason with him. She called a manager who escorted him to customer service. Shaken, she moved to the next customer in line. We've all witnessed uncomfortable scenes like this in public places. My reaction when I see them is both personal and professional. I'm a data analyst and a sociologist who studies how and why people interact with one another, or why they choose not to. To me, the grocery scene was another example of how our trust in others has eroded, but it was also a teachable moment on how we can rebuild our faith, starting with just one person. America's diminishing trust has been making news for years now. At our peak in the late 1960s, more than half, 56% of Americans, surveyed said they thought most people can be trusted. By 2016, fewer than one in three agreed. Trust in our institutions, including politics, the media, and our employers, has fallen too. The United States now trails most developed countries by global measures of trust. How can you tell whether you are a trusting person? Try this test. If you lost $100 while running errands, would you expect someone to turn it in, or would you assume the first person to find it would take off? These expectations represent two types of trust that social scientists study, and both are at the heart of the trust crisis. The first, more optimistic kind, reflects what's called generalized trust. It's based on the idea that people generally share your values and would treat you as you would. You know that you would return a lost wallet, so you have faith that if you get yours back. It's worth noting that people who trust others by default, people who experience more generalized trust, report being happy, healthy, or more resilient to life's ups and downs. The second, more pessimistic view is called particularized trust, meaning you tend to trust only particular people, people who believe or act the way you do. So while you know you would return the wallet, you also know that most people aren't like you, and therefore you wouldn't expect to get it back. Here is the problem. In our increasingly polarized world, roughly a quarter of Americans have particularized their trust over the last 50 years. Because of this, millions of Americans have become less willing to rely on or to help most people, and they have lost confidence in the value of public services. Because fostering trust and elevating the national conversation have long been central to Reader's Digest values, the magazine has been creating surveys over the past few years to measure the country's mood. This year's survey, conducted in November 2017, with the survey company Ipsos Connect, asked Americans the hypothetical questions about the lost $100. It found that our trust in people across most professions in our lives, from mail carrier to lawyer to grocery clerk, sits well below 50%. The most trustworthy, the family doctor. Nearly half of us didn't trust the next-door neighbors or co-workers. Also telling was the fact that trust levels marked by income varied by income, by race and ethnicity, and even by location in the country. That has fed the crisis, too. What may restore trust among one group might not make sense for everyone else. There is no quick fix. Still, I'm convinced that Americans could choose to trust one another again. I wanted to listen to people on the front lines of the issue, people out there trying to make a difference. So I began a podcast in 2014 called The Plural of You. That's pluralofyou.org, for which I've interviewed dozens of trusting individuals about what motivates them. One of the most impressive people I've met is Pardeep Kalika of Milwaukee. Kalika's father founded the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin in nearby Oak Creek. On August 5, 2012, a white supremacist shot and killed six members of the temple, wounded four others, and then turned his gun on himself. Kalika's father was among the dead. Kalika and the congregation could have easily shut out the world after the incident. Instead, they found unite.org, a nonprofit that conducts talks and workshops on trust and unity in schools and communities across the country. We know the shooter wanted to be isolated and miserable. Skylake said, to battle that, we needed to get out into the broader community. In other words, we need to learn to talk to one another, even in uncomfortable circumstances or perhaps especially then. Back at the grocery store, my wife and I reached our flustered cashier. I grabbed a bottle of water from the nearby cooler and handed it to. We both learned her name was Beth. We felt bad about how that man treated you and wanted to buy this for you. Beth's face lit up, and we talked as she scanned our items. She told us that it had been working that evening through severe foot pain and would be having surgery later that week. We wished her well in her recovery, and she thanked us as we left. Those are balancing acts, the moment of countering social and emotional pain with healing, that will add up to restore trust across the United States. You can start that pattern in someone else's life, even a place as ordinary as your neighborhood grocery store. And here's a list of the 40 products for life, the most trusted brands voted by America. What are the most trusted brands in America? Reader's Digest teamed up with research firm Ipsos Connect to find out. We asked 5,500 Americans which brands they trust the most in 40 categories. Here are the winners. For more on them, go to rd.com/trusted brands. Always, feminine product. Body lotion, Aveena. Interior paint, Behr. Health insurance, Blue Cross Blue Shield. Cruise line, Carnival. Vitamin, Centrum. Allergy relief, Claritin. Nutrition bar, Clif Bar. Pharmacy and drugstore, CVS. Intercontinence pack product, Depend. Soap and body wash, Dove. Retirement investment services, Fidelity. Coffee, Folgers. Ford. Our truck van, Ford. General large kitchen appliances, GE. Resort, Hilton. Home improvement store, Home Depot. Cold cereal, Kellogg's. Salad dressing, Kraft. Mouthwash, Listerine. Bathroom cleaner, Lysol. Washer dryer, Maytag. Life insurance, MetLife. Pet treat, Milk-Bone. Cold and flu remedy, NyQuil. Anti-aging skincare, Olay. Cat food, Purina. Dog food, Purina. Hot cereal, Quaker. Non-dairy milk, Silk. Laundry detergent, Tide. Hybrid electric car, Toyota. Car, Toyota. SUV crossover, Toyota. Headache pain reliever, Tylenol. Wireless provider, Verizon. Credit card, Visa. Eye care product, Visine. Mass merchandise retail store, Walmart. Weight Watchers, weight loss system. And which group has faith in others? Exploring the demographic patterns in the Reader's Digest poll. Whom do you trust more, a coworker or your next-door neighbor? It might depend on where you live, how old you are, or your gender. This year's Reader's Digest Ipsos Connect survey reveals a host of fascinating demographic patterns. American adults generally trust their family doctor, but people 55 and older trust him or her far more than those under 35 do, 80% versus 68%. For women overall, the most trusted person aren't their doctors, but their in-laws. And generally, Northeastern trust more than Southerners do, though the differences aren't large. Wealthy people are more trusting than people earning less than $25,000, and whites are more trusting than Hispanics or African Americans. No matter their earnings or ethnicity, one group stood out for their confidence, readers of this magazine. The survey found that folks who read us regularly have far more faith in others overall than non-readers of the magazine. Can the R&D trust factor become contagious? We hope so. That would really make us proud. Linda, what a pretty name. In 1947, after Jack Lawrence's song Linda hit number one, 5.5% of the girls born in the U.S. were named Linda. Since then, no baby name has become so popular so quickly. Oddly enough, the Linda who inspired the song, the daughter of Lawrence's lawyer, became even more famous in 1969 when she married a guy named Paul McCartney. That's outrageous. Bad sports. Marathon runners in China were rewarded with a gift bag after the race. One of the goodies was a fruit-flavored bar ensconced in its pretty English-language wrapper. In fact, the Royal Orchard bars were fruit perfume soap, according to the BBC. Witnesses reported many bars of soap, all with one bite missing, dumped on the roadside. Great news. For a player on the Gateway Grizzlies, a professional baseball team in Sauget, Illinois, With his team losing 3-0, he cracked a grand slam to take the lead. Bad news for the player. The ball sailed into the parking lot and smashed his own car's windshield. The nominees for the craziest injuries ever. 1. Olympic swimmer Ryan Locke, who tore a ligament in his knee while catching a teenage fan who jumped into his arms. 2. Baseball player Brent Maine, who missed several games with back spasms, triggered by trying to look both ways before crossing a street. 3. Hockey goalie Glenn Healy, who required 10 stitches after he cut himself while putting together his bagpipe. 4. NASCAR driver Jimmy Johnson, who broke a wrist during a celebrity golf tournament after falling off the top of a golf cart. An umpire at the ATP Challenge Tour in Nottingham, England, penalized tennis player Brian Klein for calling a player on the court a stupid, stupid person. The player Klein was berating was himself, and he was right. The penalty cost him the game, set, and match. From fan to fanatic, a New England Patriots fan tattooed Tom Brady on his lip so that the quarterback's name would always be on the tip of his tongue. Meanwhile, a Green Bay, Wisconsin man married a woman named Packer and took her last name. And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. How to clean practically anything. Curtains. Are dingy drapes darkening your home? Dust them regularly with soft brush attachment on your vacuum on a reduced suction setting that you don't draw the fabric into the nozzle. You can also stretch an old nylon stocking over the nozzle, secured with rubber band to act as a screen, or a soft, long-handled broom with synthetic fibers. These are better than natural fibers at collecting dust. For a deeper clean, follow our steps below. Step 1. Check the care labels to ensure that your curtains, including the lining and seams, are made of a washable fabric. Always dry clean drapes with stitched-in pleats, swags, or other ornamentation. Remove hooks and weights, loosening the tape so that they lie flat. Now measure the curtain length and width to use as a reference to stretch them back to shape later if needed. Step 2. Set your washer to a gentle cycle. Using lukewarm or cool water and a mild detergent, curtains can be very heavy when wet, so don't overload your machine. To dry, hang them on a clothesline. If you can, or put them in the dryer in a no-heat or delicate setting. Step 3. Ironing should be done while the curtains are still damp. Run the iron along the vertical length of the side that won't show, and stretch the seams gently to avoid puckering. Then spread the curtains out gently, pulling them to the right size before they dry. And here's something that's very timely to us, particularly. Tick-proof your yard. Even if you live in a state with fewer reports of Lyme, Rocky Mountain, spotted fever, or the other tick-borne disease, such as Anophthalmosis, Babesiosis, Yersinia, and Tularemia, don't let your guard down. At least one case has been reported in 48 states shown above, and there's a map with all over the country. To protect your shelf, follow these expert tips. Say nay to sprays. Spraying your entire yard with pesticide can be ineffective and provide a false sense of security, said Michael Hansen, Ph.D., senior scientist at Consumer Reports. Instead, consider placing tick tubes, cardboard tubes stuffed with cotton that has been treated with tick-killing chemical permethrin, along the edges of your yard where rodents may pass by. When mice collect the cotton for their nests, the permethrin, which doesn't harm mice but may harm cats, binds to their fur oils, killing any ticks that try to attach. Cut grass low. Normally, our lawn experts suggest around 3 to 4 inch grass, but ticks like to climb to the top of tall blades, looking for the chance to grab onto hosts, and they enjoy the shade that shaggy lawns provide. If you're concerned, stay closer to 3 inches and use a strong trimmer on tall weeds. Bag your clippings. If you live in a tick-rich area, it's best to bag your lawn clippings when you mow, because clippings and leaves, while good for your grass, provide the shady cover ticks like. Make a mulch moat. Adding a 3-foot-wide barrier of mulch around the perimeter of your yard does double duty. First, it creates a physical barrier that's dry and hot, something ticks can't tolerate. Second, it serves as a visual reminder to be extra careful once you step past the perimeter. Use mulch made from broad, dry wood chips, not the damp, shredded variety, which creates conditions favored by ticks. Now here's an interesting part of the article. Is Amazon Prime membership worth it? An annual subscription to Amazon Prime, which offers members swift two-day delivery, costs $119 per year. But to know whether it's worth the money, you'll first need to evaluate your online shopping habits. If you order just a few items from time to time, you may not need membership because Amazon.com offers free standard delivery when you buy $25 of eligible items in one order. You do get additional services with membership, such as music streaming and cloud storage, but if you don't take advantage of these, you might be overpaying. To help you decide, here's a brief rundown of Prime perks. Free same-day delivery. Prime members qualify for free same-day delivery on more than a million items, as well as Prime Now, available in select cities, on tens of thousands of items, which promises free delivery within 2 hours or within 1 hour for $8. For restaurant orders, delivery is usually within an hour from Amazon-affiliated restaurants in select areas. Video streaming. Members get instant access to thousands of movies and TV shows, including Amazon Originals. Music streaming. Prime Music offers ad-free listening to more than a million songs, plus playlists and stations. Prime Photos. You'll have unlimited photo storage in the Amazon Cloud Drive. Early lighting deal access. Members can act on short-term, deeply discounted items 30 minutes before everyone else. Kindle Owners Lending Library, which I use extensively. Members can borrow one title per month with no due date and have an early access to one free book per month with first reads. Amazon Family. The benefits include up to 20% off diapers through the site's subscribe and save service. Membership sharing. Two adults and four teens can share certain Amazon Prime benefits at no added cost. In-home or in-car delivery services. Prime members living 37 eligible metro areas can download the Amazon Key app into a smartphone to allow Amazon couriers to put packages into a home entryway or even in the trunk or cabin of a car when you're not there. But Key will cost you an additional $220 on top of the annual Prime fee. For that, you get an Amazon-compatible home smart lock and camera so that you can get in-home drop-offs, although there is no charge to let couriers access your car. However, the car must be a certain type, such as a 2015 newer Buick or GMC vehicle equipped with the OnStar Telematics service. The car must also be parked in an open, street-level, and publicly accessible area. Prime and privacy. Although in-home and in-car delivery are designed to thwart package theft by porch pirates, the services also raise some security concerns of their own. In 2017, researchers demonstrated a security flaw in the Amazon Key app that allowed couriers to re-enter a customer's home after a delivery was complete. Amazon says it has fixed the issue. Couriers for in-car deliveries will have access to the inside of vehicles and any valuables or personal information that may be left there. But an Amazon spokeswoman, Kristen Kish, told CR that delivery personnel are thoroughly vetted and comprehensive background checks and motor vehicle records reviews. For some shoppers, those security concerns may be offset by the system's convenience. What's the best time to buy some items? Gas grills. If you're in the need of a new barbecue, be sure to check out 4th of July sales for we're past 4th of July for good deals. Insect repellents. As summer buzzes along, keep an eye out for lower prices on bug repellents towards the end of the month. Dryers. You may see prices drop around the July 4th holiday, particularly on past year's models. And once again, we have the 100-calorie looks like. Everyone loves a cool summer snack, but portion control is key, says Amy Keating, a registered dietitian at Consumer Reports. And many frozen treats contain added sugar. So along with calories, note sugars and try to stick to low amounts. Outshine fruit bars. 2 bars is equals 100 calories. Marinos Italian Ice, lemon flavored, is 1 cup. It has 24 grams of sugar. Creamsicle Original. Boy, I remember sucking down those. Cream bar. Sugars have 12 grams. 1 bar. 2/3 of an ice cream sandwich of a Nestle vanilla. Sugars are 9 grams. 2/3 of a bar of Good Humor Strawberry Shortcake Dessert Bar, 7 grams of sugar. Food Sleuth. A glass all the way full. After decades of research, observational studies, the evidence is pretty clear. A moderate amount of alcohol in your diet can boost heart health. But when experts say a glass of wine is good for you, they're talking about a single 5-ounce serving of red or white for women and up to 2 servings for men. Men are allowed more to account for their generally larger size and difference in the way they metabolize or break down alcohol. Wine glasses, however, come in a huge variety of shapes and sizes, ranging from around 6 ounces to more than 30 ounces, which can make it tough to judge the amount of wine being poured. In fact, one 2017 study found that people were more likely to pour more than a serving's worth into larger glasses than into smaller ones. And we have an image here who shows just how different 5 ounces of wine can look in 5 differently shaped glasses. Use it to guide your pour, no matter which color wine you prefer, then simply sip your glass and enjoy and put a stopper in the bottle for tomorrow. And they have a regular standard wine flute. Looks like it's about 2/3 full. Then they have a fat flute. That's about a quarter full. Then they have another flute that's a little wider and a little taller, and that's about a quarter full. Then they have what you would normally see in a restaurant, a standard white wine glass, and that's about half full. And then they have a glass with no stem. It's a round bottom on it, and that's about, maybe an inch high. So it's easy to overdrink these things. Money-saving appliances. In an exclusive survey of more than 42,000 Consumer Reports members rated retailers, telling us which ones had the best price and selection for major and small appliance purchases. The top retailers to buy major appliances. ABT Electronics and Appliance got 93. Amazon.com got 92. Costco got 91. Nebraska Furniture Mart, never heard of that, got 91. R.C. Ryder Home Furnishings, 91, never heard of them. Warner Stella, 90, never heard of them. Independent retailers, now we've heard of those, they got a 90. Top retailers to buy small appliances. Once again, ABT Electronics and Appliances got a 93. Amazon got a 93. Williams-Sonoma got a 91. QVC, that's the TV thing, got a 91. Costco got a 91. And manufacturers' websites got a 90. And then we have a list of websites of recalls. Halogen light bulbs. HEB is recalling about 2.5 million GTC halogen light bulbs because they can shatter while being used, posing a risk of laceration and fire. The bulbs are sold at HEB stores and online at heb.com from August 2015 to December 2017 for about $2.20 for a two-pack and $4 for a four-pack. What to do? Stop using the light bulbs immediately and call HEB at 1-800-432-3113 or go to heb.com for a full refund. Pacifiers. Handicraft recalling about 590,000 Dr. Brown's Lovely pacifier and teeth holders because the snap can detach from the pacifier's ribbon and pose a choking hazard for young children. The pacifiers were sold at stores and online from August 2015 to March 2018 for about $10. And they're really cute. It's a little bunny rabbit. What to do? Take the pacifier away from young children and call Handicraft at 833-224-7674 or go to drbrownsbaby.com to get a free replacement product. Safety switches. Schneider Electric is recalling about 1 million Square D brand safety switches because the power can stay on when the safety switch handle is in the off position, but posing a risk of electrical shock or electrocution. The switches were sold at stores and online from January 2014 through January 2018 for $40 to $500. What to do? Inspect the switch by moving the handle to the off position. If the power stays on, call Schneider Electric at 877-672-1953 or go to Schneider Electric U.S. Glass Safety Alert for instructions and to get a free replacement. Laminators. 3M is recalling about 395,000 Scotch thermal laminators because the plastic enclosure can overheat and pose a burn hazard. The units were sold on Amazon.com from July 2015 through March 2018 for about $20. Stop using the laminators and call 3M at 1-800-772-4337 or go to scotchbrand.com for a full refund. Pressure washer surface cleaners. Briggs & Stratton is recalling about 201,300 PSI Briggs & Stratton Craftsman brand pressure washer surface cleaners because the spray bar can break off and detach, and broken pieces can strike users. The products were sold at stores and online from March 2010 to February 2018 for $50 to $80. Stop using the cleaners and call Briggs & Stratton at 877-370-7505 or go to briggsandstratton.com to register for a free replacement. Kids' Tents. Jewett Camera Company is recalling about 84,000 Playtime Pals pop-up hideaway hut. Children's tents, because the fiberglass rod that supports the tent can break, splinter, and become sharp, posing a laceration risk. The tents were sold at Home Depot stores during November 2017 for about $13. What to do? Stop using the tent and call Jewett Camera at 800-955-2879 or go to jewettcameron.com to return the tent to any Home Depot for a full refund or store credit. Ceilings fan. HD Supply is recalling about 144,000 Seasons brand ceiling fan because the bracket connected to the fan blades, can break and allow the blades to fall, posing a risk of injury. The fans were sold at HD Supply stores and on the company's website from March 2016 to February 2018 for $60 to $140. Stop using the fan and call HD Supply at 1-800-782-4154 or go to hdsupplysolutions.com. Click on the resources and product recalls for a free repair kit. Oh, kids' hats and flashlight sets. Spirit Halloween is recalling about 20,000 Nickelodeon Paw Patrol Deluxe Marshall hat with flashlight sets because the batteries in a flashlight can overheat, causing it to become hot and posing risk of burns and fire. The sets were sold at Sprint Halloween stores from September 2015 through November 2017 for about $13. Take the flashlight away from the children, remove the batteries, and throw away the flashlight. Call Spirit Halloween at 866-586-0155 or go to SprintHalloween.com to get a full refund. You will be asked to provide a photo of the tag located under the ear in the hat. So don't throw it away until you've taken a photo of the ear. Wi-Fi switches. Southwire is recalling about 24,000 Y-on indoor in-wall Wi-Fi switches because they can overheat and pose a fire hazard. The switches were sold at stores and online for about $40 and about $80 for a three-pack. What to do? Stop using the switch and call Southwire at 888-770-7156 or go to Y-on Products, that's W-I-O-N products.com, or southwire.com to get a $4 to buy a standard non-Wi-Fi replacement switch. You'll also get a full refund once you return the recalled switch to Southwire. Consumers should hire an electrician to make the replacement, and Southwire will reimburse for this expense. How to play it cool. A programmable thermostat can cut annual cooling costs by 10% as long as you program it. Householders with a product programmable thermostats are 48.5 million, households that program it, 14.2. So what's the point of having a programmable one if you don't program it? Our air conditioners and thermostat ratings, plus our expert buying advice, will help you boost the heat and lower your utility bills, too. Window air conditioners should keep you comfortable for 8 to 10 years, and a central air system can beat the heat even longer than that. But eventually, they all lose their cool, leaving you to wilt once the weather turns warm. When your air conditioner is nearing the end of its life and stops cooling, even after you've cleaned the filter, it's time to start looking for a replacement, says Chris Reagan, Consumer Reports senior air conditioner tester. If you do need to buy a new model, the good news is that both window and central air units can cool more efficiently than those made even a decade ago. Sizing up the options. CR's air conditioner ratings will help you feel the window unit that's best for you. But first, you'll need to determine just how much space you'll be cooling. A model that's too small won't cool adequately, and bigger isn't always better. An air conditioner that's too large may cool too quickly and not remove enough humidity, leaving the room feeling cold and clammy. For rough guidelines on the right size and unit to be, see what size air conditioner you need, which I will look at in just a second. If you're unsure about the square footage of your space, multiply the length of the room by the width. Add together the square footage of all the rooms that aren't separated by doors if the unit needs to cool a large open space. For complicated floor plans, bring measurements to the store and rely on a salesperson's expertise. Energy Star recommends that you consider the following. for a very sunny room increased capacity by 10%. If more than two people regularly occupy the room, add 600 BTU for each additional person. For a kitchen aircraft, increased capacity by 4,000 BTU. Before buying a window air conditioner, remember to make sure you have correct type of electrical outlet. Models larger than 15,000 BTU usually require more voltage than smaller units. Voltage is indicated on each model spec sheet. If you're planning to install a large air conditioner yourself, consider buying one with a slide-out chassis. This allows you to attach the cabinet and adjustable side curtains to the window before sliding the heavy mechanicals into position, rather than wrestling the whole unit into place while it teeters on the windowsill. Most new window units come with installation panels to place over the plastic adjustable side panels, Reagan says. But to maximize efficiency, you'll still need to use weather stripping around the perimeter of the unit. And always use the manufacturer's installation and safety hardware. Window unit alternatives. Window air conditioners aren't always an option. Not every window can accommodate one, and some buildings don't permit them. A portable air conditioner is an alternative, but not an ideal one. We tested 12 models, and none received the overall score higher than good. And at 50 to 80 pounds or more, they're hardly portable. Plus, they're bulkier, noisier, and more expensive, and they use more energy than conventional air conditioners. Another option is a split ductless system. Like central air conditioning, these condensers place outside the home, but instead of venting through ductwork, a ductlet unit cools via an air handler mounted high on an interior wall. There are currently no split ductless units in our rating, but in past tests they generally did an excellent job of cooling and were much quieter than window units. Compared with conventional room air conditioners, a split ductless system can cut cooling costs by 30%, according to Energy Star, but they're more expensive and require professional installation. What size air conditioner you need? For a bedroom or home office, 100 to 300 square feet, 5,000 to 6,000 BTU. And the one they recommend is the GE-AHM-05LW, $190. Master bedroom or playroom, 250 to 400 square feet, 7,000 to 8,500 BTU. The Kenmore 77080 at $270. For a living room, family room, or open plan, square feet of 350 to 650, BTUs of 9,800 to 12,500. It represents the LG LW1216ER for $350. How to lower utility bills when the temperature rises. That's a convenient thing in this part of the country. 13% of a home's energy costs are for cooling, according to Energy Star. Here are three easy ways to rein in those expenses, even on the hot summer days. Turn up your fan. Instead of setting the air conditioner 74 degrees or 76 degrees Fahrenheit, set it to 78 and let your ceiling fan do the rest. It costs little to run and can make the temperature feel as much as 4 degrees cooler, according to the Department of Energy. Number two, make simple changes that increase efficiency. Close curtains during the day to keep the sun from eating up the house, reduce oven use, repair leaky aircraft air conditioner ductwork, and plug cracks by the windows and doors. Number three, replace your thermostat. If you have central air conditioning, one of the most effective ways to save money on cooling is to install a programmable or smart thermostat. As a bonus, you'll also save money on heating this winter. Programmable thermostats can be set to a schedule, typically one for weekdays and another for weekends, that reduces the amount of cooling or heating when the house is empty or when you're sound asleep. According to the Department of Energy, a programmable thermostat can reduce cooling and heating bills by 10%. Smart thermostats connect to the Internet via Wi-Fi and allow you to control your central air and heat with your smartphone. Some smart thermostats keep track of your temperature preferences and use the data to optimize your cooling and heating schedule. Others have multiple sensors that monitor temperatures in various parts of the house for more balanced cooling and heating. For the fully automated approach, try the Nest Learning Thermostat, or Nest Thermostat E, which uses sensors and geolocation to learn when you are and when you're not at home and adjust the temperature accordingly. Models like the Carrier Car Thermostat offer manual control and remote control from a smartphone, but very little in the way of automation. The Honeywell Lyrix T5, Econobee, and Econobee 4 offer a hybrid approach to those who require some automation, but still want a full set of manual control features. Before investing in a smarter programmable model, Check with your utility company to see whether it offers any incentives or even a free thermostat. Many offset the cost of with rebates or discounts. For ratings and prices for these and other thermostats, we'll look at a pricing later. And they have a picture of the Net Learning Thermostat for $250. Central air conditioner reliability. Almost 90% of new homes are built with central air conditioning. It's not practical for Consumer Reports to test central air systems because too many variables can affect performance. Instead, we estimate the reliability of major brands based on the experiences that thousands of our members report in surveys. Choosing a brand with a lower breakage rate will help boost your chances of getting the system. Estimated likelihood of a breakage at the end of the fifth year of ownership. American Standard is 15%, Trane is 16%, Bryan is 16%, Lennox is 17%, Carrier is 18%, Amana is 18%, Rude, R-U-U-D, is 21%, Goodman is 22%, Rheem, R-H-E-E-M, is 24%, and York is 25%. Since we're still in the grilling season, let's go ahead and talk about various things about grilling. How about food poisoning and summertime food safety? Food poisoning picks up in the summer. These precautions will reduce the chances of sickness spoiling your cookout. Handle with care. Store raw meat in a sealed bag or container to prevent it from contaminating other food items. Marinate in the refrigerator and discard the marinade when done. Do not use it as a sauce. Keep it clean. Never place food, cooked or raw, on a plate that has held raw meat, poultry, or seafood before washing it thoroughly with hot, soapy water. Wash utensils that have come into contact with uncooked meat of any kind before using them again. Track the temperature. Use a meat thermometer to make sure the meat has reached a sufficient internal temperature to kill harmful bacteria at least 145 degrees for steaks, roast, and chops, and fish, 160 degrees Fahrenheit for ground beef or pork, and 165 degrees Fahrenheit for poultry. Note that cooking meat on a very high heat might not be an ideal way to get that safe internal temperature. Researchers eating a lot of heavily charred meats may increase the risk of cancer. Cold foods such as potato or chicken salad need to be kept at or below 40 degrees Fahrenheit to prevent the growth of harmful bacteria. Toss perishable food that has been left at room temperature for more than 2 hours, 1 hour if the temperature is 90 degrees or above. And let's have a face-off for charcoal. Which is better, lump or briquette? Our testers answer this burning question. They have a picture here of Big Green Egg hardwood charcoal, which is regular charcoal, not briquette, $1.25 per pound, and Kingsford briquettes, which are 54 cents per pound. And then they also have a Weber 22-inch pot grill with an overall score of 67. Lump charcoal, the favorite fuel of many grilling purists, promises hotter, larger burn times than standard charcoal briquettes. Some people also prefer lump coal's more natural composition. Though briquettes are made primarily of sawdust, lump charcoal is simply charred wood. But is lump charcoal really worth its premium price? To find out, we tested Kingsford's briquettes, 54 cents per pound, and Big Green Egg hardwood charcoal, $1.25 per pound, in two types of grill, a traditional Weber kettle and a Big Green Egg Komodo-style grill. In both grills, the lump charcoal did burn slightly hotter, 40 to 50 degrees. But for evenness, briquettes were the clear winner. If we scored this test the same way we measure evenness, performance on gas grills, the lump charcoal would have earned a score of fair in the kettle and very good in the Komodo grill. The briquettes would have earned excellent scores in both grill types. We think briquettes are better suited than lump charcoal to most grilling tasks. They're also easier to stack, control, and light, which a lot of backyard chefs will appreciate. We suggest that you save lump charcoal for the times you need to sear a thin steak or pork chop without overcooking. How to keep your grill in peak condition. Grills take a lot of abuse from in-season smoke and grease to off-season snow and ice. Follow our cleaning care advice on seasoning to improve your grill's performance and keep it working longer. Pre-season, unless you're a year-round griller, which a lot of people in this part of the country are, chances are that your grill will need a good cleaning before you fire it up for your first cookout of the year. Examine the inside and clear away any spider webs which can cause serious flare-ups if they ignite. Reconnect your propane tank, open the valve, and spritz the flexible gas line with a mixture of water and dish soap. Look for any bubbling which can indicate a possible leak. If you spot one, order a replacement gas line. Be sure to test the newly installed line with the same soapy water mixture. Before each cookout, Weber, the largest grill manufacturer in the U.S., recommends brushing grates after a 15-minute preheat because the heated food debris will turn to ash and will be easier to brush off. You'll also need to empty the drip tray, which collects fat, to avoid a mess and reduce the chances of a grease fire. Any flakes you see forming on the inside of the top lid might look like paint, but they're actually grease and smoke deposits. Use a stainless steel brush to scrape them off so that they won't end up in your food. Periodically during the season, scrub the inside of your grill, including the covers on the burners on gas grills, with soapy water and a scouring pad from time to time. How often depends on how frequently you're grilling and what you're cooking. If it's fatty meats, you'll need to clean more frequently to help prevent flare-ups. Protect your grill whenever it's not in use with a cover made of waterproof, breathable material, such as heavy-duty polyester. Most brand covers are designed to protect a particular model. If you live right on the ocean or in a particularly humid area, however, leave your grill uncovered except during long periods of inclement weather to avoid tapping salty or moist air that would cause the grill to rust. People in these regions should also wipe down the grills once a week to remove salt deposits and accumulated moisture. At the end of the season, scrub your grill inside and out, use soapy water in the firebox and on the grates, and a multi-purpose cleaner on the exterior. Store your grill covered with a propane tank disconnected. That way, if anyone bumps into the grill in the off-season, there's no risk of inadvertently turning on a burner. A detached garage or shed is a fine place to store propane tanks, but never bring them into the house or an attached garage. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for print and for people who are blind and print impaired. Sorry about that. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast and on our website, triangleredingservice.org. We would like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the Reading Service. If you have any questions or comments, or would like to be a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Reading Radio Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.